called Messiah in 3 weeks. Everybody's always, wow, I mean, that's just amazing that you could write that fast and get all that done. But the reason he could do it in 3 weeks was that, yes, he was brilliant, and he did compose quickly, but he also borrowed from himself, which was very common in those days. The idea was, if you had a good tune, why not use it over? Why would you use it just once and then dispense with it? So Bach did that, Handel did, all those people. They all borrowed from themselves if they had a good tune. And so he did the same thing for some of the music in Messiah. And other parts, he of course wrote original music. The piece is really an opera, because there is no difference between an opera and an oratorio, except in an opera you move and in an oratorio you stand still. There is no other difference. Both have three things: recitative, aria, chorus. Recitative simply means that you advance the action, whether it's an opera or an oratorio. All the action, the storytelling, all happens in recitative. That's always text that doesn't get repeated. And so there are various kinds of recitatives, but basically you are going to tell a story, and so you're saying, you know, I wish to go to the restaurant tonight. I'm very much looking forward to it. I'll be taking my car down there. I'll be parking my car, and I will enter the restaurant for a wonderful meal in which I will eat the following things. That's recitative. Aria: this food is good. Oh, is it good? It is so good, good, good. It tastes good. It is good. That is aria. Aria simply gives you an emotion, a reaction to what it was. It does not advance the action. It simply tells you how you feel, how the character feels. Chorus is just that. We have more people involved. And so a chorus can either help to advance the action, they can create a scene. They often are what we call environment. They help to just set the location that you're going to be in. They may respond to something. If someone says in an aria, to arms, to arms, to arms, and suddenly the chorus goes, we come, we come, you know, right? I mean, that would be a chorus response. So, as I say, the only difference is that in oratorio, you stand still. In opera, you move. Now, Handel wrote when he came to England, back in the 1720s, he, of course, born in Germany, then he was in Italy, then he came to England. When he came to England, he was writing a number, because it was very in vogue, he was writing a number of operas in Italian, and that was very much the rage at that time, and he became one of the real, that's when he got his first great acclaim. And he, of course, was also acclaimed by the royalty in England, and that did not hurt him one bit. He was he really knew how to, not only to compose to their best advantage. Now, what happened, of course, is that in England, the ecclesiastical authorities decided long about in the late 1730s, 1740s, that during Lent it would no longer be appropriate to have opera. We did not want to see that kind of movement on stage. And we needed to just simply not, this is a time of penitence, we do not need to see this kind of stuff happening. And therefore, there were going to be 6 weeks in which George Frederick Handel wouldn't make any money. And he went, wait a minute, this is not a good idea. And so he said, well then, rather than have opera, why don't we just have people orate? Hence, oratorio. So basically, you had these people up there singing, but they just didn't move. That was okay with the church authorities to do that.
Which king was
and
that?
So,
Which king was that?
George the Third.
Oh, George.
And so they then started, you know, to have oratorio. But Handel, not in every case, not in the case of Messiah, but basically he was always thinking of these oratorios as pieces that later on would get staged once Lent got over. And if you read some of the oratorios, they have stage directions in them. And so, I mean, it's like exit, come in, it's all there, you know. Messiah was the exception. He was asked to write the piece for a hospital in Dublin as a charity. And he agreed to do this, went over and went to these opening, was there for the premiere. After it was done, it was a big success there, brought it back to London, was not a success at all. For a number of reasons. One of the reasons was that the alto that he hired, because Handel was also, obviously he had this music he'd written, he wanted it to be performed well, so who were the best singers? That was important. So he went and found the alto that he hired would have been sort of Barbara Streisand of her time. And he had this great voice, really communicated, was wonderful. The problem was, she was, as the church authorities said, worldly. And so therefore, how could you possibly have someone like Barbara Streisand singing, "He Was Despise It"? This is not a good idea. Though it was effective and wonderful, it was still wrong. So they just said, "Oh, this terrible, terrible thing." And so it was not a success. The next year he brought it back, and by then word of mouth had spread that, you know, this was really quite a good piece he'd written. And so people then got all excited about Messiah and decided that they would come and attend, and the rest is history. And then it's had many, many different performances. Of course, in its original form, it was a very compact little piece. Would have had an orchestra of probably, no more than 24. Would have had 4 soloists. Would have had a chorus of maybe the same, 24. Not a big piece. I mean, over the years, it then started to become, was done by larger groups. People really began to want to do it, and it became these mega kinds of performances, even leading up to having like 1,000 singers perform it. I'm not interested in hearing that performance, but I'm sure it was something to think about, those melismas in 4 on Once a Child Is Born, with 1,000 people going, woo, woo, woo. I don't know what that would have been, but anyway, not a good experience. So,
what language was it written in? What language did he write it in?
English.
He did write it in English.
He wrote this in English, and it is said that, I mean, this is just superstition, but it is said that Handel wrote Messiah and his other oratorios with a pen in one hand and a dictionary in the other. Because he was German, after all, and spoke German first, spoke Italian second, English was his third language. And there are places in Messiah that don't quite work in terms of English language. I mean, it's sort of like getting the emphasis on the wrong syllable, you know, that kind of idea. And so he wrote the piece, and as I said earlier, it was called Messiah. It was never called the Messiah. It's just Messiah. And you find that when he started to write it, what he just knew was most important was to figure out a plan. He had his librettist who gave him the arias and the order. And as I say, you have your recitative, advance the action, and he sort of figured out, you know, how the story needed to progress. Don't forget, this was done during Lent. This was not a Christmas piece. There's a Christmas section to Messiah, but that just needed to happen. We needed to have the birth of Christ. That was kind of important. But then we needed to move on into the Lenten section and the resurrection section. Okay? So it was done during Lent. When he decided to write this, and he needed to put a plan in mind, He needed to figure out a kind of direction so that it wasn't slipshod, so that you just weren't sort of going from key to key to key to how can you make this piece work. Therefore, what composers have used for hundreds of years as a kind of guide is this. This is supposed to be a circle. It looks like an oval, but it's really a circle. So it's called the circle of fifths. And the circle of fifths is the system by which, if you learn to play any instrument, you started with C because that has all the white keys on it. And then you started moving. So you had C. Now we're going to go around to the left side, your left side. Okay? So there's. Now we're going to go up a fifth. A fifth means five notes. Okay? And then we're in G. One sharp. Now we're going to go up to two sharps. D. Now we're going to go up five more notes. And then we're in A. Now we're going to go up five more. We're in B. And then we're going to go up five more. And we're in F sharp. Now, at that point, F sharp, of course, is, as we say, enharmonically. It's the F sharp and G flat are the same note. So, if you stop there for a minute and you come down the other side, you can keep going in fifths. These are all fifths going all the way up so that you start in C. Yeah, I mean, you go, and then you keep, I haven't got enough keys to keep going up chords. But if you come down this side, that's the flats side. This is the sharp side. If you come down, these are all in fourths. So you see you've got four notes. So you'd have C, again, no sharps, no flats, up to one flat, F, up to two flats, B flat, up to three, up to four, up to five, up to six, and you're in G flat. You meet down here. Okay, now, the reason for this simple system is that normally a composer, if they're doing a work in multiple movements, tended to kind of move in one direction or in the other direction so that you weren't jumping from C to B to F to A. You weren't going to do that kind of thing. You were going to progress a little more. Now, I don't want to make this too complicated, but what you also need to know is that every major key has to have what we call a relative minor key, okay? So, they are not the same. In other words, C major and C minor are not going to be the same. F major and F minor will not be the same. And consequently, in music, the normal way you would know if people are paying attention to what they do is that all the major, if you see a piece of music and it says prelude in C, if it's a major, it should be a capital C, and if it was C minor, it would be small C. Now not everybody remembers to do that, but that's the rule, okay? So, a lot of people then say C major, C minor, but if I see something and someone's written an F, but it's just a small F, I know it's F minor. I know that it's not going to be F major. So, the minor keys, therefore, are going to be, we have to make them related. So, you're saying, okay, so here's C major, all white notes. If I'm going to find the minor one that's all white notes, it's going to be A. So, that means that A minor, which is right here, is going to be the equivalent. If I needed to have, because you don't want to stay in major all the time. I mean, there's some moments of sadness. We got to go minor. So, you know, so then you're going to have A right there. And consequently, if you're going to go around then G major, you're going to find that its minor relationship right there is going to be, they're always a third off. So it's going to be E. And if you do this whole system, this is going to be B, this is going to be F, etc. You'll have these minors that are always the third lower than the majors. And that goes all the way around. That doesn't change going around the scale. So consequently, someone, let me put a few of these in because you'll see in a minute why you need to know that. This is going to be G minor, and that's going to be C minor there, okay? Great. Now, the other thing to realize about this time in music history, this is 1740. We were not all the instruments could play like they can today, okay? So this was particularly true of the trumpets and the timpani. They were excellent in the key of D major. That was a real good key. They sounded in tune in that key, you know, right. And so consequently, what you will find in Messiah, because he didn't want to use the trumpets and the timpani all the time, he wanted to use them for the moments of, you know, of great grandeur, glory, finale, whatever. What you will find in Messiah is, I mean, this is where the genius of Handel comes in. Every moment of completion dramatically happens in D major. And so you always know if you're looking for the major spots in Messiah, every one of them is in D major, because then he could involve trumpets and timpani. Okay? He could have involved them in other keys and they would have sounded out of tune and they would have gone away because they couldn't play in those keys. And that all changed in the 1800s. But back then, it wasn't. So everything is in D major, which means that, for instance, the first, you have all that opening. You got the overture, Comfort Ye My People. We'll talk about this in a minute. Comfort Ye My People, every vow should be exalted, and the glory of the Lord. Then the bass comes and sings, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, but who may abide the day of his coming? And the chorus sings, and he shall purify the sons of Levi. And then, moment of importance, and the alto sings, Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son. D major. We needed to have that. Okay? So the first time you hit D major, and he didn't use the timpani and brass at that moment. But the first moment of importance in terms of where the drama is headed was to D major. And so that's why the alto can sing, Oh, thou that tells good tidings to thee. Right, and go right on from there. So that's the first moment of that. Then you never go back to D anymore for a while. Then we plunge on and we've got the people that walked in darkness, for behold, darkness shall cover the earth. Then they come in and sing, For unto us a child is born. And all of that comes in. But then the soprano sings, There were shepherds abiding in the fields. But that's not in C. But suddenly, when it goes, and suddenly there was with the angel. And that's because now we got to get the angels to come down with the message. And so then we suddenly have. And that's all D major. Right. Because then when the chorus goes, you know, there you go. And then we can bring in the timpani and trumpets. Okay? So that's D major. So that's the second time that you have sort of a big moment that you've been looking for. Okay, now let's go back a minute. There's more of them, but you get the idea. So he started this piece. Think about it. All right, we know we've got to get there for Behold a Virgin Shall Conceive. So you have to kind of figure out your plan moving back from that. How are you going to, you know, you don't necessarily want to just traipse around. You can cross over, of course, if it's a relative relationship. So he decided, he started his piece in the key of E minor, right here. That's not a C, that's an E. All right, he started in the key of E minor. Okay, so the overture. Etc. Okay, and then, you know, and he did it very, what we call French formal style. There was that bam, ba-bam, ba-bam, and they followed it with a fugue. We won't talk about what a fugue is, but. First subject. Second. Etc. Okay, right. So you go all the way through the fugue, and you get done with that. E minor. You've been there all the time. Now, here is first Handel brilliance. Because if he was a lesser composer, Handel would have gone, somebody would have gone just up and down the scale here. But Handel did not want to go there because he wanted, again, he was an opera composer. Opera is all about knowing how to use dramatic sense of words. So what's the first word in Messiah? What's the very first word?
Comfort.
It's the first word. Comfort ye my people, but comfort. Comfort is the word. So how does one musically achieve comfort? Well, simple. You've been in minor, and you want to have comfort. Go to major. Ah, I feel much better now. I'm in comfort, you know? And so, now, you understand the listener doesn't have a clue. They haven't even heard the word comfort yet. But what he did is sets up the comfort musically before the tenor ever says comfort. So by the time the tenor comes in, you already have moved from this moment of E minor anguish to E major comfort. And so he went from E minor to E major down here, which worked because he needed to do a text idea. You go to a performance of Messiah, and after the overture, they take a pause to let in the latecomers. Please register a complaint, because you have just lost the first dramatic moment of Handel. Because by the time you take a minute's pause to let in the latecomers, everybody forgets about that relationship of E minor to E major. The latecomers can come in after D major gets reached. Let's get to the first moment of drama, and then they can come in after that. Because then we have to have a little pause and blow the nose and carry on and go there. But not right away. So you've got to be able to go right from E minor to E major to achieve that. And then, within, of course, these pieces, Handel, Bach, all of their contemporaries knew also about word painting. And word painting is doing stuff like E minor to E major. But word painting is also about setting certain words. For instance, there is no place in Handel that you will ever hear people talk about heaven on low notes. You will never hear anything about earth and hell on high notes, ever. It's all just, it just makes sense. Of course, you're talking about heaven, you're up there, hell, down here. And so when Handel writes, has to set words like the crooked straight, you know, so what does he do? Crooked is crooked, straight is straight. The crooked, straight, and on straight you just stay on one note. You don't move, you know. The crooked straight. You know, right, you're straight. All right, okay. And the rough voice is playing. Jump all over the place, because it's rough, you know? And so that's why you get the rough voice is playing. The rough voice is playing, and the rough voice is playing off from there, you know? You don't have to know any of this, except subliminally it all makes sense. And even, I mean, one of the reasons that pieces like Messiah are beloved are that sense of word painting that you don't have to know it, but if you do know it, it just enhances your appreciation for the music. That's all. You know, so the next time you hear, you'll hear that. You go, oh yeah, there's Ruff. It's playing. Got it, you know? It just goes from there. So you have those kinds of relationships happening. There are two kinds of recitatives. They both do the same thing. One recitative, both of them, as I said at the beginning, advance the action. That's what a recitative is supposed to do. It recites. So you have two kinds, what are called accompanied recitative and what are called secco or dry. Secco means just, you know, those kinds. That's a secco. Bump, chord, sing. An accompanied recitative means that something is going to continue underneath the recitative. So when you have the very first recit, comfort ye my people, you have both. The first half of it is accompanied, you know, comfort ye. Comfort ye my people. So it's all accompanied recitative. But at the end of that, then it goes, the voice of him that crieth in the wilderness. Well, those are just dry ones. So those are the two kinds. And so Handel has to kind of choose which one do you want, mainly just depending on the text. You know, what did you want the text to show? So he did that. Then he went right from there, recitatives, not 100%, but almost always, recitatives are followed by arias. So you set up all your action, and then you exclaim about that action in some way, some emotional response. And so your first aria is, every valley shall be exalted, and every mountain and hill be made low. And so, you know, it becomes, he just, you know, he was in here for comfort, and he just stayed right there. I mean, that was just a great key. It's exalted. And so exalted is the word in which you have your melismas. Melisma is simply a word that means you sing a lot of notes on one syllable. You know, you just, you know, so that shall be, you know, shall be, I'm not a tenor, shall be, you know, all in one note, all exalted. And what are you doing? Exalt. It's the word you want to emphasize. So when you're a composer and you see a text, you know, and this is no different today than it was back then, you look at the text and say, what's my key word? Every word is not equally important. I tell this to singers all the time, in chorus, when I'm coaching solos, everything. Look at the text and decide, what are the words that you'd have to know and the audience could fill in the others if they had to, you know? And in this one, you'd have to know valley exalted. You could figure out the rest of it if you knew those two. You wouldn't need anything else. So exalted, you know, it shall be exalted. And so there's lots of exalting going on in that aria, you know, right on its way. And then finally, after he's done that, that's when he does the crooked straight. The crooked straight. And he stays on one note while the orchestra is still crooked, you know. The crooked straight and the rough places play. Smooth pain. And then we have rough, the crooked straight, the crooked straight. You know, right, so you got crooked, you got straight, you know. And that finally gets all done. He finishes this, we're not going to get through all of Messiah, we'll just get going here. Okay, so, but if you got this idea, it just keeps doing it all the way through. Okay, so he's ended up in E major, and he's on his way because the next one that follows it is, and the glory of the Lord, in A major. So he's coming around his old circle of fifths. Now, Every Valley was original music. He wrote that. That didn't come from anything else. And the glory of the Lord, you know, as I said at the beginning, Handel, like all those good composers, and composers still do it today. Dominic Argento just recently wrote this wonderful piece that he borrowed from himself. He said, well, I wrote this good melody about 30 years ago, and I thought I could use it again. I said, yes, good idea. And Handel had written a piece for two French horns and strings. It started like this. Same thing, but it was basically that he went, you know, if there's that good French horn duet, this would be perfect right now. So why don't I just use it again? But it doesn't work in F, let's put it in A. And so he did. So he just used and the chord with a little bit of mind. You know, you didn't have to do it exact. No. So he changed it a little bit, and we went into A major, and we did And the Glory of the Lord. And again, you notice, folks, every time you say And the Glory of the Lord, never does the Lord go down in the cellar. The Lord is always up here. You know, everybody sings, right, which is why at the end the sopranos hopefully give us a high A that we are interested in hearing, you know, because when they get that, and then you all cross your, you know, right. And as I always say to sopranos, now, ladies, if this is a note that you do not possess, simply open your mouth and give me, oh, my God. And we will all think that you are singing it because your neighbor is singing it. But do not give us something that we're not interested in hearing. And so, you know, oh, it's true. Oh, yeah. That's fine. I mean, you know, because if you've got like 20 sopranos, you know, and if, you know, the high notes, you never need as many people anyway. And so if five could sing it well, you know, 15 could go. And we would think all 20 were singing it. Really and truly. It's a, you want to encourage people not to go beyond what is beautiful, you know, right? So anyway, so they goes to the end of that, and he finishes it, you know, has spoken it. Now, you say, well, great. We've been here every valley, and the glory of the Lord. Hey, we're on our way to D major. The problem is, dramatically, we're not ready to say, behold a virgin. We got more text to set yet. So we don't want to go there quite yet. So you are here in A, and so he does this wonderful thing and goes, instead of going to D major, he goes to D minor, which is full of drama. Ooh, boy, there's a good dramatic. D minor is always great for drama, you know. And so the bass comes in and sings, thus saith the Lord of hosts. And you've got to set it up. I mean, you know, here's another accompanied recitative. And recitatives have to be set up with their appropriate drama. So, you know, I suppose you could go, thus saith the Lord, you know, that'd be okay. But it's much better to have heard, thus saith the Lord. Whoa, there's something major going to happen here dramatically. The Lord of hosts, you know, yet once a little while, and I will shake. And then he starts shaking, right? He goes, shake. He's shaking all the way through, you know, all those little stepwise. The heavens and the earth, the sea and the dry land, and then Handel, brilliant. And I will, and then he starts big shakes, and I will shake, and I will shake, etc. You want a better bass than I am. So then, at that point, he's got to have a lot of text. All nations, I'll shake the hems, the earth. But he still needs to have you, as a listener, feeling shaking. So he gives it to the strings. And so, you know, he goes, after he does his shaking, they do the shaking. And I will shake, and I will shake. And they're all shaking, you know? So you always still have shaking, but now the strings are doing it, you know? And then finally he does, and the desire of all nations shall come. You know, a lesser composer wouldn't have known how to do this. But what he does is starts on a low note on the melisma for desire and goes up high so that your desire keeps rising. You know, your desire does not go down there, it goes up here. And the desire of all nations shall come. You know, right. But you're not done with your recit, but now we go to secco. The Lord whom ye seek shall suddenly come to his temple, even the messenger of the covenant whom ye delight in, you know, etc. We have a little more material to finish. So then he says, behold, he shall come, saith the Lord of hosts. Well, you've just had this huge amount of prophecy, big time. And you know, Now, you could have just moved on into some big, dramatic, huge thing, but how wonderful for Handel. He totally takes you the other way and becomes one single violin. You've just been, and then you sit here. And you have this long introduction to an aria that says, but who may abide the day of his coming? And who shall stand when he appeareth? And then you just keep, it's an aria, so keep repeating words. Who shall stand, but who shall stand when he appeareth? And on the word appear, which is the key word, you have a long melisma, he appeareth, when he appeareth. And then the other half of that aria, the next sentence is, for he is like a refiner's fire. Well, Handel, what a great moment to have flames in the orchestra, And so the orchestra then goes, for he is like a, and they, who shall stand when he appears? And then they go. Because in the strings, it's much easier, you just go, and so the whole time too, they just are, they're all the flames. And he's going, for he is like a refiner's fire, and there's all this kind of stuff, and all the flames. And then he gets to the end of it, and what's quite wonderful is that and then you think, oh, it's done. And then he does a shortened, but who may abide, one more time, not so long as the first time, and then you have a shorter refiner's fire, and you finish with that, and you okay, so now you have just finished in D minor. So, we still have one more text we've got to get in here before we are at our crucial point. We've got to sing, and he shall purify the sons of Levi. G minor. Ah. Nice relationship. So it's easy to go from here to here. Okay? And we can go. So he didn't have to write that new, because when in the 1720s, living in Italy, Handel wrote a whole series of love duets in Italian for two women. These were these little Cupid duets that he did. And they're charming. And he went, I can use one of those. And so this is one of the duets that's all about how, the flowers in the field are lovely, but then when they start fading, it's just like your love for me doesn't work very well, And so they do that, So he just used that same music, and then it just became, and he shall purify, and he shall purify sons, etc. And that just gets to the end, sons of that they shall offer unto the Lord an offering and sacrifice. And then he goes across, and you go very nicely from G minor to shall conceive and bear a son. First important fact that you're coming to, the birth of Christ. And that, of course, had to be in D major because it was one of the pivotal dramatic moments in the piece. And so, just an accompanied recitative, very sweet chords. None of this kind of stuff. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son. No. Gentle. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel, God with us. And then, as was typical with that period, how lovely to think about the happiness with a nice dance, a nice little kind of Sicilian. And you know how nice you could just great moment, O thou that tellest good tidings to Zion. And then the alto comes in. You know, and if people, one of the best things that happened to me in my freshman year at the University of Minnesota was taking music history from Bob Loudon, who partway through the Baroque section of the year said, okay, now, if you're going to learn about minuets, Sicilians, chaconnes, gavottes, we must all dance them up. So we all got up, and he'd play some recording, and we'd learn the dance step to do a chaconne, and then we'd go do a sarabande, and we realized how tempo affects dance. What a surprise that you can't zip through a sarabande, but you also don't want to, if you do a gavotte too slowly, you know the gavotte, you know, like... starts on the upbeat, so your left foot starts it, you know, etc. So you do those, well then you had to kind of move or you'd fall over, you know, right, if you weren't. So you learned all of these things. So Handel used a lovely little dance. And then the wonderful thing at the end of O Thou That Tellest is that when he came to the end of the alto, is risen upon thee, there's no pause, but suddenly the chorus comes in and says, amen, and they repeat the same text, and that's when you get that. It's just a kind of nice swing to it, you know, and you've set up the whole thing. So that's the first chunk of Messiah, is to get you from the overture up to the first moment of importance right there. Before I move on, I will just tell you that my interest in this piece goes back to age 6 when I was taken. My mother said there was going to be a performance in town in Austin, Minnesota, with big chorus and orchestra of Handel's Messiah. And I went, oh, I want to go. So I sat there with her, you know. I don't remember seeing a lot of other six-year-olds in the audience, but anyway, then went there and went to this thing, and I came home and I just went, oh, you know, all I want for Christmas is a copy, a score of Messiah. And I got one, which I still have, my old G. Shermer score, you know, and I just loved it. I don't know that a lot of other kids got one that year, but I got one. So I had, oh, that, you know, and oh. And then I decided the next thing was I should write an oratorio, you know. And I decided it should be some big text, and I would do the creation. I hadn't heard of Haydn yet, and so I did, you know. And I started out, and what a surprise that my piece, I'd skipped the overture because I knew the overture is hard to write. And I started with started with a tenor recitative in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And then there was a tenor aria. And then there was a chorus on There Was Light. And then about that time someone said, you know, Haydn has already done this. You know, so I put it, I didn't finish it. You know, I mean, you know, after that, I thought it's already been done. That project is taken care of. Anyway, but over the years, I mean, I just loved it, memorized the whole piece, and, you know, it's just stuck with me. And it never has worn out. I mean, Handel, not just in Messiah, but in his music, was so brilliant at word painting, such as what we're talking about here, that it really, it's not just in this work, but in all of his works. It's quite amazing how he was inspired by the text, or inspired perhaps by a particular singer. Many times, composers, Mozart, often would write arias that were phenomenal because he was writing for a certain singer that he knew that singer's voice. And that's very common. They do it today. They do, you know, if someone knows who is going to be, I mean, when Dominic wrote one of his operas for New York City Opera, he knew Beverly Sills was going to sing it, so he knew what she could do, and he wrote it for her, you know, and if somebody else came along later, well, good luck. But, you know, you were writing it for a person, and he did that. So let's do a little bit more. So we finish that first little section, and then he jumps now from, we finished D major, now we're going to go to B minor, and that's just the relative to D major. So you're already right there. You're here. Now you're going here. Okay. You've just finished a huge amount of joy. It's been great. Now, suddenly, the bass comes in and sings, "For behold, darkness shall cover the earth." This is just like Comfort Ye My People. Before you ever hear a word from the bass, look, those words, "For behold, darkness shall cover the earth." Darkness is never like a door. Doop! It was light 1 minute, it's dark the next. Darkness sneaks up on us. So, handle. Here's darkness. Start with one note, go to two notes, go to three notes, go to four notes. Three, four, and five. And gradually, darkness starts seeping over all the land. So that by the time you end up, so when the bass comes in and sings, "For behold," and then he says, and also, folks, certain words, "behold" is never "behold." "Behold" is always means attention. And so if you're going to get someone's attention, you always go up to get attention. But then you say, "Darkness shall cover what? The earth." So you go on down for your earth, you know, "and gross darkness the people." And then he takes just one little moment in this piece and goes back to D major, because he says prophetically, "But the Lord shall arise upon thee." And so you finish that whole first part, you know, "and gross darkness the people, and gross darkness the people." And then he goes, "But the Lord shall arise," and you only arise up, folks. You never arise down. So you go on up and you arise. You know. So if for just a moment you went to D major, but then you come back, you end up back here when you say, "And the Gentiles shall come to thy light, and kings to the brightness of thy rising," and you're there. And you follow it, of course, with an aria. And the text says, "The people that walked in darkness have seen a great light." Well, what do you do? How do you set that up in your mind before you hear them? What Handel did, I've never talked to George about this, but I really think that if I did, he'd agree with me. What he did is, it's as if you were a blind person, and you are suddenly in a room, you have this room, you have no idea what you're in for, stumbling over a chair, banging into a post, whatever. So here's the introduction to the people that walked in darkness. You start gingerly, because you don't know what's coming up. And you go, yeah, you're like, oh, okay. But eventually you bang into something. The only aria in Messiah that has no accompaniment to it. It is not filled in with harmony like It's to be just the notes. Walking in darkness, have seen a great light, and then once again you have a little bit of "have seen a great D major light," but then you go back, "but they that dwell in the shadow, upon them hath the light shine," and you end up here. So you finish in B minor, and you can just hop right up to G major for "unto us a child is born," and now it's time for another Italian duet. Another one of those Cupid numbers, where, and they're really cute numbers anyway, but you get this, they go, the first one goes, "No, you are unfaithful, I don't know why I ever trusted you. No, 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 don't tell me, check one more, Prudel Belta, check one more, Prudel Belta, no," second one, "Job is born." It's exactly the the same thing until the very end. He had to change it a little bit because in Messiah, he had to get wonderful counselor into it. So he had to change it a little
bit. Now, what key is that in? What key is that in?
G major.
But he uses timpani in G, in the wonderful counselor.
He uses
timpani.
D.
Okay.
No, not in Fourth of Childless Born.
Yeah.
No.
Wonderful.
No, that's not.
No.
That's not the same song.
No, that's in. Not in that one. Believe me. No timpani there. No, they're just there. It's just basses and bassoons. Yeah. The Hanser, the mighty God, the everlasting Father, the Prince of God. And so they then finish. I'm going to get you to the next D before lunch. So they finish that one. So we get all done with that. Then he needs to set up the shepherds coming in. And so what he does is goes back and uses a little form of music that he had known in Italy called a pifa. And pifa, there's a little instrument called the pifaro, which was like the little flute the shepherds played. They got the sheep to come, you know. And he wrote a little short 12-measure piece. Later it was extended, but at the beginning it was just, you know, and it was just. You know, and kind of deal. The only piece that you might think of contemporary like it was when Pietro Jan, also Italian, decided to write a piece in the same style called Gesù Bambino, which goes. Another little pifa is what he did, you know. But Handel was in C major. So he finishes that, and the soprano goes, still in C. There were shepherds abiding in the field, keeping watch over their flock by night. Now we move to F major, and there's one angel. It says, and lo, the angel. And how do we know there's one angel? Because the violin is playing the angel's wings. There they are. And lo, the angel of the Lord came upon them. Just one angel, and the glory of the Lord shone round about them. And they were sore afraid. Now we continue recitative. And the angel said unto them, etc., fear not, etc. And then finally the last one. And suddenly, D major, because we have a major dramatic moment. And suddenly, much wings. We're not done. We got many angels have just suddenly shown up. And they're all flapping. And then she says, and suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of the heavenly host, praising God and saying, and suddenly, glory to God. But when the chorus sings that, there are no basses because they're up in heaven yet. We're not down on earth. And angels, of course, were celestial. So therefore, we have just soprano, alto, and tenor. Glory to God, glory to God. And they go, and then they say, and peace where?
On earth.
Way down low, of course. It's never up here, you know. And then they say, and it's after the opening is when we get the timpani to enter and the trumpets when we get goodwill, 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 goodwill. And then a great thing happens, which not everybody is always aware of. There's a postlude, but why is there a postlude? Pianissimo. See ya. And they're gone. You know? And it's the only time in Messiah that Handel, because you know, in that period you didn't write in dynamics because you just told the people, because it was never going to be for posterity, so you just told them what to do. And it's the only place he wrote in dynamics. and marked it at the end pianissimo, so that indeed the strings would know that they had to fade away and be the angels and gone. That gets you to that far, and it's now time for lunch. So, there we go. Thank you all. Thank you.
Was it ever done as opera? Or?
No. Oh, I've seen, you don't want to. I mean, he did not ever think of this as an opera. This was a piece that he did not think of that way. Though I have seen productions of it that should not have been, and it doesn't quite work. Behold a virgin, no, it isn't a good idea. Okay. It doesn't work as well.
Did you have a lot more here?
Oh, I can go through the whole piece, but you see, we've only gotten up to what, number 20 or something. It goes up to number 52, Worthy is the Lamb. I mean, my word.
That amen part is the best.
The amen and Worthy is the Lamb, that's also in D major. I mean, the other D majors, you have to get to D major, of course, with Hallelujah Chorus, when you say, for God the Lord omnipotent reigneth. So you gotta be there, and you gotta be in D major when you say the trumpet shall sound. First of all, because the trumpet could play in D major, that would be a good reason. But also because the text said, and the dead shall be raised, that was an important dramatic moment in the Christian story. And then finally, Worthy is the Lamb that was slain. And those are all the big moments in D major. So I always say to anybody who's conducting it, just know where your big moments are headed, and know that you're going toward them, rather than each little piece pause. So if you go to a performance and they sort of have major pauses between each movement, it's like, folks, no, this is just an oratorio that's, you know, it's opera. We're just standing still, that's all, you know? I mean, can you imagine going to some opera like Barber of Seville, and you do the first piece, and then we just stand for a minute, and then suddenly we go, oh yeah, well, I think I'll go on now. We wouldn't think of doing that. Well, this is the same way. We need to keep the action going so that people really feel that the story is moving ahead. That's why oratorio and opera are exactly the same in terms of how a composer has conceived them. They're not to be done any other way. Elijah of Mendelssohn, it's an oratorio. My mother was involved years ago in a stage production. The problem, she said, was that when Elijah called for the fire from heaven, it didn't work. So someone lit a match, and they got, the fire descends from heaven. Oh, okay, good, right. Somehow the stage direction didn't work. That performance up in Duluth, but, right. But, it's the same deal. You got to move it all ahead. So, thank you all. Sorry not to get any further, but there it is. Okay. Jacob.